Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. What's wrong with California's energy policy and why? We'll discuss this and nothing else with guest Jason Fordney as part of our special sponsored series on energy. We've been doing a number of these episodes throughout the last several weeks. Your regularly scheduled programming will return with our next episode. Our sponsor is ClearPath, an organization devoted to breakthrough energy technologies that you can find at clearpath.org. Jason, by the way, is a veteran energy journalist focused on California and emerging Western energy markets. He has more than 20 years of experience at leading global and national publishers, and you are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. And with that, thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thank you, Rich. How are you?
Very good. So appreciate you coming on. So situate our listeners a little bit. How did you get into this covering this area, and how long you've been doing it, and for whom, and that sort of stuff?
Yeah. Sure. Well, my background, I was a traditional newspaper reporter in the D.C. area, Arlington. Was there, I wrote for the Arlington Journal, was there for 9/11, was, crime reporter, and then moved over to energy around 2002. I started working for a trade journal that was based there, and then I've been covering energy ever since, about the past 20 years, and then I worked for some of the larger news agencies around DC, like McGraw-Hill, Argus. These are trade journals that they publish, commodity pricing indexes, but also a lot of news. And then, in 2017, I came out here to California to cover the state, strictly energy, and have been doing that ever since, and enjoying the kind of wildlife out here in California. I live in Nevada City in the up in the Sierra foothills in the kind of rural area, and but I'm fairly close to Sacramento, where the legislature, of course, meets, and Folsom, where the California Independent System Operator is. So yeah, since 2017, I've been covering strictly California energy policies.
So when you were down in DC, did you ever have an office in the press club?
I didn't have an office there, but I hung out there a lot at the Reliable Source. I have a lot of fond memories.
Oh, yeah.
I
when I was a reporter for National Review covering Washington for a time, we had a little cubbyhole of an office in the press building. And then I'm a native Arlingtonian, so I remember the Arlington Journal. I'm not sure whether it's still publishing, but the Arlington Journal and the Fairfax Journal.
Yeah.
And I worked for my second job out of school was with a local newspaper in Fairfax County. They're very kind of micro community coverage, the Herndon and Reston Connection. These connection newspapers out in Fairfax County. So
that's funny. I started out at Times Mirror. So Centerville Times was my very first journalism job.
Yeah.
$18,000 a year. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. I think I made 10 at the connection correctly, but it was a little bit before you. All right. So energy. This is obviously, as I said at the top, part of our energy series, and we're going to dive into California, which is a big part of this debate, a pioneer, if you look at it one way, or a watchword for failure, if you look at it another way. You're not in the business of opinion, but you're in the business of reporting and knowing the story really well. So first of all, I don't write about this a lot, but I occasionally do. And one column I did a couple of years ago, it's just so remarkable how much higher prices are in California. you know, gas prices, you name it. So why is that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. You know, gas, the gasoline is a different dynamic. There's some mystery out here as to why the prices are so much higher in California. You know, they've been holding some hearings on that. On the power side, there's various reasons. You know, the way, just to briefly describe the way it works out here, we have a wholesale energy market where power is bought and sold by utilities. It's operated by the independent system operator, CAISO, which also operates the transmission system. So you have a wholesale market and then the retail market and the retail prices that we pay as, say, a customer, Pacific Gas and Electric. So there's kind of a two-tier system there. When it comes to the retail bill, there's been a lot of cost impacts. For one, billions of dollars in wildfire costs and mitigation. Obviously a big issue here. And that has really driven some of the extreme, you know, this is billions of dollars going into ratepayer bills. And also natural gas has a big impact. The price of natural gas has a big impact on the wholesale price of electricity. And it is passed down. What people might not realize about the West is it's fairly sealed off. You know, we have a limited pipeline system. There's always problems, you know, exploding pipelines. It's an ancient system. And then you don't have much transmission interconnection with over the Rockies either. So there's essentially three grids in America: the Eastern Interconnection, Western Interconnection. What we're seeing now, right at the moment, very low prices in the Midwest, very high prices in the far West, because we don't have that connectivity, and there's people working on that. So a lot of different dynamics, I would say. Right now, the price of natural gas, really high, I mean, insanely high, which is driving up costs, and there's, you know, various reasons for that, global dynamics, et cetera. And I can drill down on any of these different topics.
So when you say the system's ancient, is this pipelines or every means of getting it energy further west?
Yeah, well, the pipeline system is antiquated, has a lot of problems. They blow up from time to time. You know, we had the San Bruno tragedy in Southern California. And then, you know, we've had lines blowing up out in the desert in recent years. And it takes a long time to get these pipelines back in service. There's even been, you know, allegations of foot dragging by some of the pipeline companies on repairs. You know, sort of market manipulation stuff. But, you know, it's the Wild West out here. I won't deny that. There's one thing I've learned is just, you know, there is a certain amount of corruption out here. But, and a lot of utility power, a lot of utility hijinks. You know, Pacific Gas and Electric, the largest IOU out here, is a convicted felon. All kinds of history with that that people are probably aware of. Politics, you know, so it's a big mix. There's no question that the high amount of regulation in California does increase the prices, the customer bills, electricity bills also.
And what about reliability, which has been on people's minds a lot? Obviously, we had this, when was it? Time runs together for me. Yeah. I don't know, in the fall or the summer, the notice is sent out, you know, don't plug anything in, you know, from 5 to 7 because it's dusk and that's where people most use the most electricity. But that's also when, you know, the sun's going down and the wind might not be blowing, and please don't plug in your electric car right at that time, which is kind of an irony. So is that just a function of the high degree of reliance on wind and solar?
Yeah, that definitely plays a big role. There's not sufficient generation capacity when the sun goes down every day. And you can see on the, you know, CAISO has charts of the grid output. You can just see the solar rising, obviously, in the mornings and through the noon period. And then, yeah, late afternoon starts to fade out. And that's, you know, that's when the demand tends to increase. Before COVID, that was when everybody went home, fired up their appliances.
Right.
There's no doubt that the penetration of solar is a big factor, and the retirement of gas units and also coal units, not in California, but around the West. California also imports a large amount of energy. Those imports are dwindling. So what's happened in the recent years is in that period, that evening period, when the sun goes down, all the utility solar drops off. There's not enough power. And we have a tight market.
Is it when the sun is literally down, or is it even when the sun is getting lower in the sky? It's not providing energy.
Sure. When it starts to wane, or if, you know, there's events, we lost 30% of our solar at points in the fire season because of wildfire smoke. Or
in the sun.
It blots out the sun, or you have a cloudy day. It affects that. But really, if you're looking for the root cause of this, it's really the policies of the state legislature that have driven the planning, the retirement of traditional fossil resources. We all know why they're doing that. And
So do they say, you know, this much capacity needs to be shut down, or do they say this plant in particular has to go, just regulate it, knowing it'll be hard for some people to keep up and they'll blink out of existence? Or how does that work?
Well, it's really difficult for the gas plants to be economic in this environment. They're not economic to run, and there's been a lot of pressure at the political level and also at the regulatory level, the CPUC, the Public Utilities Commission, to retire gas units, to not renew them. It's become gas last 10 years become public enemy number one with the energy planners. And they've bet it all on solar, and now we have these issues, and now storage is going to be the saving grace.
So can you elaborate a little bit? Why is it hard for the gas units to, what's changed about the environment specifically?
Well, for one, they're not designed to run this way, to ramp up and down.
You're relying on solar during the day and then you just need it at night.
Yeah, it's basically, we need you when we need you. The rest of the time, we don't care about you. And, there's local pressure. The environmentalism is obviously huge in California. It's just the way the economics work in the market, the gas units, you can hear from companies like Calpine, we can't make any money with our gas units. So they end up retiring them. What happens is, which is very interesting, CAISO ends up paying these units to stay online. That's called reliability must run. I've written about it extensively. And they will actually say, hey, we need you here. We're going to just pay you. And that's not the way a market's supposed to work. So we have kind of upside down situations here. And now, of course, California is building a lot of emergency backup. $5 billion has gone into this. And what are they building? They're building gas. So retire the baseload units and then build temporary backup.
Yeah. So the it's a little shades of Europe having to backtrack after getting a little over their skis and their enthusiasm.
Sure.
For the renewables. But has there been a mandate, this much has to be solar and that's just the way it is? Or how has solar been promoted?
Well, California in 2018 passed SB 100, which is a zero emission law by 2045 for the power grid. So, the most ambitious renewables policy that you can have, so that's wind and solar. Nuclear, not very popular. That's the policy SB 100, and it's been building to that, since 2010, 2012.
What hope is there to have storage for solar and wind that would be economical and reliable? My understanding is it's just an enormous technological challenge. We're just not there yet.
It is. The nice thing about solar is, storage, is you can put it on existing sites. It's a lot easier to site than, say, building a new power plant. And that's how we've seen, I think we're up to 4 gigawatts of storage added in the past couple of years, which is remarkable. I mean, it's in a massive build out. Of course, storage doesn't generate power.
For the ignoramuses, at least I'm one of them. So that's a lot, four gigawatts.
Sure. Yeah. yeah. You know,
how much is it taking to turn on my lamp, and how's that compare to 4 gigawatts?
That's a tiny bit of a kilowatt, but you know, I guess you can look at a power plant as being maybe 500 megawatts to a gig. You know, Diablo Canyon is a 1.1 gigawatt. Unit. So yeah, 4 times the capacity of Diablo Canyon.
Okay.
And this is all lithium ion battery storage, which has its own set of issues. I've written about this. Basically throwing a ton of storage at the system, and it's starting to make a difference, but it has its own set of issues, as I said.
And so talk a little bit about wind. Is that kind of like solar, but more of an issue with intermittency, or what are the advantages and disadvantages of it?
Yeah, wind definitely highly intermittent, a lot more difficult to plan. They do a lot of wind research, and there's a big movement here to build some offshore wind, which we don't have any of that here on the West Coast yet. But there's no doubt wind is extremely intermittent. If you ever drive by a wind farm, you can see how many of the blades are turning and how many are not. Mm-hmm. And, that's the big issue with solar and wind. It's not just myself saying this. You know, the National Reliability Corporation, NERC, we've been writing about this recently. They'll just come out and say they're not a political organization. You know, it's the increasing amount of intermittent generation, which is going to create a lot of challenges along with the coal plant retirements.
Yeah. And then nuclear, which is renewable and does not have intermittency issues, is not just not in political favor, obviously.
No, it's not. You're probably familiar with Diablo Canyon. Yeah. You know, it was never a popular facility from the beginning.
It's not the most charming name. It's not the most inviting. It doesn't give you a lot of comfort necessarily. It sounds like the place where there'd be an accident.
You're right. It sounds a little devilish, I guess. But yeah, when Diablo Canyon opened, there was massive demonstrations. And of course, recently the decision was quickly reversed to retire it. And now with $1 billion coming from the federal government to keep it alive, looks like it's going to operate longer than was planned. Yeah.
And what went into that? How significant was that decision?
A lot of people think that it was the state that shut Diablo Canyon down. It was actually the owner, Pacific Gas and Electric, that proposed shutting it down. And it was interesting. I was just reading the proposal, and what they said was there's not going to be a need for it. Here's a quote. PG&E believes the continued operation of Diablo Canyon beyond 2025 would exacerbate overgeneration. So I don't know what happened there, but that didn't happen. So overgeneration, obviously not a problem now, but it was a concern not that long ago that there was too much capacity on the grid, and they don't like that. The politicians don't like that. But now we're seeing, once they started modeling taking this thing away, it was a real risk. You mentioned our outages. Early September, this past September, we came extremely close to rolling blackouts, and then we did, of course, have the reliability blackouts in August 2020, which were the first to happen since the energy crisis of the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And that brought a lot of attention to California. It really opened up the state to its critics. Blackouts are the worst possible outcome for everybody. And they're very serious, and narrowly avoided them in September.
Just because they, I mean, they just affect every aspect of life, and at the very that they're the problems, obviously, but a huge economic cost.
Oh yeah, we don't just have those. We also have the public safety power shutoffs, which began in 2019, which they shut the system down because the risk of fire from a line falling down, and there's reasons why these lines fall down. But we basically have two kinds of outages. We have the intentional ones. The ones that happened in 2019 were disastrous. I mean, people died. People on medical equipment can die. There was traffic accidents because of the traffic signals were down. It's chaos, you know? So, yeah, we have two sets of blackouts. But really, the only rolling blackouts we've had were in August 2020. They weren't that extensive, but they're very dangerous, and it's not what you want happening for sure.
Yeah. So Diablo Canyon is going to keep going, but any prospect of other big nuclear projects, or that's just off the table?
I think it's off the table. You know, you have the plant under construction in Georgia, Vogtle. It's hard to say, V-O-G-T-L-E, but that one has become kind of the poster child. It's billions of dollars over budget. To site and build a nuclear power plant these days is incredibly expensive. But we have small modular nuclear, which is just now coming onto the grid. It's kind of an exciting new field.
So the zero emissions thing, that again is 2045
for SB 100, correct? Yeah.
And is that, 2045, showing my age, it sounds like a long time from now.
It is.
Maybe I won't have to worry about it, but is that a realistic goal?
Well, you know, one question I constantly ask myself is, can we run this grid on sun and wind? And I don't think anybody's really proven that we can. There's studies out there. I personally have my doubts. So even
2 decades from now.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I think that's one reason they set the date that far out.
Right.
Of course, our zero emission vehicle requirement is 2035, which is a lot closer.
Right.
And we can talk about that also. But as to whether we can get there, I don't know. They purposely set the deadline very far out, you know, and the idea is it will drive the technologies that are needed to do that.
Yeah. So the fact that you have to do it will make people do it, and the kind of classic sort of forcing the spring attitude, right? You know, we'll if we got to do this, clever people will come up with a way to make it happen.
Yeah, the way it basically works is, you know, the legislature passed the law, and then that goes to the Public Utilities Commission, which will start opening rulemakings, and requiring utilities to procure renewables, and that's what's been happening the past few years. But it's not an easy thing. You know, we have a lot of supply chain problems happening from COVID that have really affected the solar industry. We have tariffs. There's forced labor concerns. Right now, there's a real shortage of power out there. There's shortage of equipment and some of the resources that we need. So it's not an easy thing to accomplish for sure.
So talk about electric vehicles. So, you know, we have Tesla, we have kind of amazing electric cars. Would have been hard to imagine 10 years ago. There's been, you know, more pickup than there was 10 years ago. There's still big logistical problems. You're a renter in an apartment. Where are you going to plug? You don't have a garage to plug in your car. Where are you going to plug it in? You know, that sort of thing. But what is the electric vehicle situation in California now? And how realistic is that 2035 goal?
Well, there's a lot of obstacles. The goal is 5 million EVs by 2030. I was just writing about this. That's about 20 terawatt hours of additional demand, which is about a 10% increase of the demand that we have now. That's a lot.
I'm just going to say, terawatt sounds like a lot. I don't know what that one is either. Once it's a gigawatt, tera, it must be pretty big.
We usually talk about megawatt hours, but terawatt hours is, it's large.
And 5 million cars, do you know offhand what proportion of the fleet that would be in California?
I don't, but I was just looking about this. Right now, EVs are about 9% of new vehicle sales, which is about 800,000 EVs. Mm-hmm. I don't know in terms of the percentage. I think I want to say we're at about 3% EV penetration right now. Of course, the law is not an electric vehicle law. It's a zero emission vehicle law. So that includes hydrogen fuel cells, but electric is definitely where the push it has been. And you're not just talking about cars, you're talking about fleets, and that's a whole different ballgame. And the Air Resources Board is passing all kinds of requirements for commercial fleets to go zero emission.
So what's the difference between cars and fleets?
Well, if you want to charge an electric 18-wheeler, you need a massive amount of power. And I think just starting to understand this, I've seen,
So fleets are like trucks or
these would be commercial fleets, delivery vehicles, 18-wheelers.
Right. I'm FedEx. I have all these trucks. That's my fleet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like, let's say you're a, whatever type of, any type of corporation that uses a truck fleet will have these requirements. Mm-hmm. But, when you have a rickety grid as it is, and I know this is something that is sort of the observation on the national level, how are you going to add all this stuff when you have blackouts? Right. And it's a valid question. We're a long way from having the capacity that we need for all this for EVs.
Yeah. So whatever the penetration is now, 3%, 5%, whatever, that's like, you flip it, it's 95% still conventional cars. And then you're going to go to, right? I mean, this is the grand vision. You get all electric cars all operating on a grid that's running just on wind and solar. That's
right.
That's the sunny uplands of their vision.
Right. You're transitioning the vehicle fleet at the same time you're transitioning the grid to zero emission. And these are all, could be viewed as noble goals. We know why they're doing this. But, the California way is just kind of just go for it, And the penalties for failure are high and the costs are high. And, it's a wild ride for sure.
So the penalties meaning to everyone from getting it wrong or specific people who won't go along or?
Well, there's a lot of issues. Yeah, the penalty for not having adequate generation capacity to power all these EVs.
Blackouts,
not being able to charge your car. There was a lot of discussion about in September, they said, don't charge your car right after they had passed an EV mandate. So yeah, it's some would view it as reckless. Others would view it as visionary, but that's, I don't think there's any stopping it at this point, but we'll see how it goes.
So how about critics on the center left who aren't conservatives who might say, look, what you're saying about climate change is out of whack and this is totally unrealistic and, let's just have good, cheap, abundant energy for now and let it go at that. But someone who sort of accepts a lot of the premises that progressives have in California, are there dissenters like that kind of from within the Democratic House, or is everyone, and I don't mean, the lower house of the legislature, but metaphorically, the Democratic House, are there people like that, or is it pretty much all lockstep? Okay. It's a debate over, we're doing it 2040 or 2045.
Well, I'd say it's pretty lockstep. It's almost a religion out here, Rich, the renewables, the evangelism, it's a very popular political position to take, and it's also about money. There's massive amounts of money coming into the clean energy sector, Inflation Reduction Act, there's billions of dollars coming for instance, hydrogen. The states out here are busy trying to put hydrogen hubs together so they can take advantage of the federal money that's coming in. But yeah, there's a great deal of idealism in California when it comes to energy planning. And it's also a very unilateral structure. It's obviously dominated by one political party, which calls the shots, and the governor appoints, you know, the PUC, the governor appoints the board of the ISO, and they're all on the same page when it comes to this, and very serious about it. And some very intelligent, reasonable, sophisticated people working on these problems. Mm-hmm. But anytime you have outages, you know, that's kind of the wall of where the public starts to raise questions, for sure.
Yeah. What's a hydrogen hub?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, hydrogen has become a focus for power generation and for transportation, developing hydrogen as a fuel source, mainly fuel cells. You can already buy a hydrogen fuel cell car. I've seen them down at the dealership here. There's amazing subsidies, but you know, you can't, for instance, where I live, you can't drive one. You can't, mm-hmm. It's difficult to drive an EV out here too. And that's my perspective. You know, I live in the mountains. So I have a little different perspective than say somebody living in downtown LA on these issues. And that's one reason I'm here. You know, I think it's important to consider, you know, there's all kinds of things happening. There's a ban on gas powered generators that's coming in. And at the same time, the grid goes out all the time.
Now that's totally bizarre.
It's extreme. You know, that I, when I started writing about this, I couldn't believe it. You know, the first thing I did when I got to California was I had to buy a generator because we had a 5-day outage. You know, I had a wife and daughter. I have to take care of them. You know, I need to be able to cook food. It gets cold here. I was astonished. And this ban was written by a Silicon Valley legislator. They don't, you know, only 5% of California residents are rural. They're mm-hmm. completely left out of the political process and the decision making on all this stuff. It's mm-hmm. you know, it's dominated by the coastal power centers, and you know, there's various reasons for it. I think it's, some of it even gets down to cultural reasons, political reasons. So they're kind of, you know, I told a friend of mine that lives out here. I said, you know, you know, they're banning gas powered generators. And he said, what? He said, wow, they really are trying to drive the rednecks out of the hills, aren't they? And, you know, that's kind of the general perception. And yeah, that there's a political aspect to this too.
Yeah. So I live in part of the world where trees fall down during storms and take down power lines, but you go about it more than a day without power, and you're in line to get a generator the next day.
Absolutely,
it's not much fun, but this has been fun, Jason. Great. Appreciate you taking the time. Appreciate what you're doing out there, providing a sound and factual coverage on this really important issue, and wish you all the best.
My pleasure, Rich. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a special sponsored edition of The Editors. Again, your regularly scheduled programming will return with our next episode. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thanks again to Jason. Thanks to ClearPath, an organization devoted to breakthrough energy technologies that you can find at clearpath.org. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're The Editors. We'll see you next time.